without remark on the shift in the Orwellian propaganda, they were transformed into Howard Hughes' money men, expertly manipulating the system. Overnight, the Beverly Hillbillies became the Boys from Brazil. In fact, there is no possible method of calculating political contributions that supports the Times' thesis about the substantial financial resources of Christian conservatives. From January 1, 1999 through June 30, 2000, three unions made soft money donations of approximately $2 to $3 million apiece to the Democrats. In the same time period, the entire category of ideology single-issue givers, from Christians to Sierra Club members, contributed just over $1 million to Bush and Gore combined. The slush fund champion of the 2000 campaign was a group that is arguably even more annoying than Christian conservatives, lawyers. According to the director of the Center for Responsive Politics, lawyers were the biggest political contributors in the 2000 election cycle, no matter how you look at it. By September 2000, trial lawyers alone contributed more than $7 million to the Democrats and more than $13,000 to the Republicans. Yet the substantial financial resources and bullying influence of the legal left was never alluded to, much less decried, in the New York Times. So how did the editors of the Times settle on substantial financial resources as the source of the religious right's inordinate influence on national politics? Are there any facts supporting the Times' thesis? Did it occur to anyone at the Times to check? No. As usual, the editors were speculating wildly and irrationally on the basis of their own freakishly narrow, insulated lives. No one at the New York Times knows anyone who could possibly be described as either religious or right. Thus, the frequent popularity of traditional values at the voting booth in national elections, and the unaccountable devaluation of the interests of Manhattan heroin addicts and transvestites, is a total mystery, suggestive of a sinister plot. It must be money. But for pure detachment, nothing beats the Times' accusation that the religious right engages in block voting. Unless you are a Manhattan liberal, the suggestion that Christian conservatives block vote more than other groups, say, blacks, Jews, Hispanics, women, or the editors of the New York Times, will instantly strike you as highly suspect. To begin with, whatever else religious right means, the absolute bare minimum requirements are religious and right. Having defined religious right as people who are right-wing, the Times then denounces them for being right-wing. The Scientologist right probably leans toward Republicans, too. Only in an environment of ideological fanaticism can a tautology be passed off as analysis. Still and all, voters who identified themselves as white religious right, 14%, were less predictable voters than people who identified themselves as either conservative or liberal without qualification, totaling 29% and 20% of the population respectively. In the 2000 election, the white religious right chose Bush over Gore 80% to 18%. Self-identified conservatives voted for Bush 81% to 17%. And self-identified liberals voted 80% to 13% for Gore. Apart from the promising development of 14% of the population cheerfully identifying themselves as a liberal cuss word, it isn't particularly startling that 80% of the people who call themselves politically right tend to vote Republican. Eliminating the tautological aspect of the religious right and getting straight to the heart of the matter, Christians block vote less than almost any other imaginable cohort. Quite a bit less, actually. In order of magnitude, and based on the 2000 presidential election, the biggest block voters were blacks, Gore 90%, Bush 8%, Jews, Gore 79%, Bush 19%, Hispanics, Gore 67%, Bush 31%, and unmarried women, Gore 63%, Bush 32%. Even people who self-identify as white religious right, a narrow category of aggressive conservatives who enjoy annoying Northeastern liberals, block vote less than blacks and block vote about the same as Jews. But you never read about blacks or Jews being easily led or exercising undue influence by their infernal block voting. To the contrary, when blacks block vote 90% for the Democrats, it's the Republicans' fault for somehow not reaching out to minorities. But when white Protestants show a slight preference for Republicans, it's supposed to demonstrate something nefarious about the Protestants. Meanwhile, the media continue to issue hysterical Klan Watch updates about the religious right, as if these phrases conveyed information of taxonomic precision. Thus, a few months after the presidential election, in which 90% of blacks and 79% of Jews block voted for Al Gore, an op-ed piece in the New York Times purported to sketch the views and feelings of Christian conservatives. Stephen Waldman, editor of an internet site about religion, prattled on about Christian conservatives, as if it were a small, closely held corporation. According to Waldman, Christian conservatives are intolerant, threatening to George Bush, and suspicious of pluralism. How about an op-ed piece purporting to analyze what white people believe? What are their hopes and dreams? Is there any internal debate among white people over the Bush presidency? Do many white people accept a limited form of pluralism? Beyond the basic building blocks of religious right, Christians who tend to vote Republican, the meaning of religious right remains maddeningly obscure. Considering that McCain's message denouncing the religious right was such an important one, a message worthy of amplification on the editorial page of the New York Times, the message might be a little clearer. Even a witch hunt requires a working definition of the witch. Are you a member of the religious right if you want your taxes cut and believe in a supreme being? Or must one also support elimination of the National Endowment for the Arts? Is an unseemly enthusiasm for the NEA's elimination the defining characteristic? One could go mad trying to nail down even the leaders of this vast and terrifying conspiracy. Four Republicans who have been frequently identified in the media as leaders of the religious right are Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, Pat Buchanan, and Gary Bauer. No meaningful classification scheme would ever lump these men together. Falwell endorsed George Bush Sr. over Robertson for president. Robertson endorsed Senator Bob Dole over Pat Buchanan for president. Bauer endorsed John McCain, even as John McCain viciously attacked Falwell and Robertson as agents of intolerance and forces of evil. Pat Buchanan defended Falwell, but not Robertson, against McCain's attacks. The point of throwing these men together as leaders of the religious right is not to explain or clarify. It is simply to say, we don't like them. They are no more or less alike than any other four Republicans chosen at random, excluding those dubbed moderate Republicans, who are all identical. The only commonality among the four is that they are all Republicans born south of the Mason-Dixon line. These purported leaders of the religious right are talismans meant to inspire fear, even as the public is trained to laugh at them reflexively. It's difficult to make a case for the Reverend Jerry Falwell as a leader of the religious right, inasmuch as his organization, the Moral Majority, disbanded in 1989. Two of Falwell's assistants at the Moral Majority, erstwhile commanders of the easily led evangelicals, wrote a book in 1999 arguing that religious people should get out of politics altogether. Pat Buchanan doesn't rank as religious right on the definition given by CNBC's Chris Matthews, who informed Peggy Noonan that since she was Roman Catholic, she was not religious right. This is meant as praise from liberals. Gary Bauer's support for campaign finance reform and John McCain led to his alienation from conservative Christians and disassociation from the Family Research Council, the organization he once led. On close examination, the vast movement of spooky sect members infiltrating the Republican Party and threatening the nation's stability always seems to come down to just one man, Pat Robertson. Noticeably, even those who monitor the religious right are hard-pressed to come up with names other than Robertson's. Church and State magazine, a publication that issues hysterical updates on the religious right, speaks of, quote, men such as Pat Robertson and his shock troops. In National Public Radio's expose on the religious right before the 2000 election, the Christian Watch expert referred only to Pat Robertson and, quote, other leaders of the religious right. When writer Andrew Sullivan wrote about the religious right for the New York Times, he described a single event, Pat Robertson's 70th birthday party. If it's Robertson whom liberals are worried about, they scare easily. Like Catholic schoolgirls engaging in wild promiscuity to prove they aren't fanatics about their religion, Robertson consistently takes the most pathetically moderate establishment positions within the Republican Party. He is, after all, a Yale Law School graduate. If Robertson were from Vermont and didn't yap about God on TV, liberals would fondly refer to him as a moderate Republican. On the eve of the South Carolina Republican primary in 1996, Robertson dramatically threw his support to establishment choice Bob Dole. Robertson's endorsement was timed to ensure maximum damage to Dole's surging conservative rival, Pat Buchanan, who had just won the New Hampshire primary. South Carolina went for Dole, and Buchanan was effectively knocked out of the race. Dole may well have been the inevitable nominee, but whatever ends up happening always looks inevitable in retrospect. A month after the House of Representatives impeached Clinton, Robertson declared on his television show, The 700 Club, that the whole impeachment business should be dropped. The Yalie advised Republicans to dismiss this impeachment hearing and get on with something else, because it's over as far as I'm concerned. In 1999, Robertson supported most favored nation status for China. In doing so, he sided with business groups against an unusual alliance of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans, as the New York Times described the contending sides. A year later, Robertson came out for a moratorium on the death penalty, fleetingly winning the respect of the New York Times. When President Bush's faith-based initiatives were being roundly lambasted in the press as a sop to the religious right, Robertson publicly opposed them. A few months after that, Robertson spoke sympathetically of China's one-child policy, which happens to include state-ordered abortions. On CNN, Robertson noted that China has 1.2 billion people, and they don't know what to do. Expressing a startlingly unchristian sentiment, he continued, if every family over there was allowed to have 3 or 4 children, the population would be completely unsustainable. I think that right now they're doing what they have to do. Though recovering liberal Andrew Sullivan says Attorney General John Ashcroft, quote, makes Pat Robertson look like a bleeding heart liberal, that's not much of a standard. William Howard Taft makes Pat Robertson look like a bleeding heart liberal. Considering the invective constantly being heaped on the religious right, it is probably not surprising that few people identify themselves as members. Religious right is always something somebody else is, like son of a bitch. A LexisNexis search of the phrase religious right mostly turns up a lot of people denying that they belong to it. This could be because there's no such thing as the religious right. A Virginia state senator championed a bill requiring a minute of silence in public schools by stressing that he was not from the religious right wing of the party. A leading opponent of legalized gambling in Missouri defended his cause by saying, "This is not the religious right. These are some of the most liberal churches in the nation." After Louisiana ranked near the top of the nation in rates of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, the governor instituted an abstinence program. The state coordinator for the program quickly explained to the media, "We are not religious right types." Even among evangelicals, only 39% claim to agree with the religious right, a polite Southern way of saying screw you to Northeastern liberals. Indeed, publicly proclaiming membership in the religious right is generally intended only to frighten liberals. And it always works. During the 2000 presidential campaign, a cheeky 19-year-old Bush campaign staffer described herself on NPR as a religious right member of the conspiracy. While conservatives deny being part of the religious right to the point of neurosis, liberals express affection for conservatives they like by warmly excluding them from the religious right. Thus, an article praising William F. Buckley for supporting national education tests, a policy favored by liberals, pointedly noted that Buckley was, quote, not religious right. And, of course, CNBC's Chris Matthews introduced a discussion of the dangers of the religious right by identifying frequent guest Peggy Noonan as not from the religious right. All this prattle about who is and who isn't a member of the religious right refers to an organization that, strictly speaking, in the technical sense, doesn't exist. If the religious right were a real organization with real power, people might not talk so tough to it. To the contrary, any mediocrity who attacks the religious right is guaranteed good press. About once a year, pusillanimous Republicans get spooked by the liberal obsession with the religious right. They convene meetings and issue press releases with vague proclamations that they, not the religious right, are the soul of the party. The Republicans' ritual denunciation of the non-existent religious right is invariably hailed as the party's Sister Souljah moment. Let's look at that. Sister Souljah is the rap singer who expressed enthusiasm for the idea of blacks taking a week to kill white people. In a taped interview with the Washington Post, she said it was wise for blacks rioting in Los Angeles to kill whites whom, she noted, have a low-down, dirty nature. Soon after Ms. Souljah praised race murder, she spoke to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition. Presidential candidate Bill Clinton spoke to the Rainbow Coalition from that same stage the very next day. Clinton's political masterstroke, the act of dauntless courage about which songs will be sung for the next 50 years, consisted of his remarking that soldiers' homicidal comments were, quote, filled with a kind of hatred that you do not honor. That's the big rebuke to intolerance within the Democratic Party. A presidential candidate stands on a podium recently occupied by the black equivalent of David Duke and timorously takes exception to the earlier speaker's enthusiasm for mob murder. An oblique statement of opposition to racial killings is reaching out to the middle for a Democrat. Naturally, Jackson demanded an apology from Clinton, saying he had shown very bad judgment in expressing his reservations about race murder. Adding to Clinton's heroism, many in the mainstream media were torn by Clinton's gentle reproach, questioning whether he had gone overboard. New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis tentatively admitted that his initial reaction was that Clinton had done the right thing. But then Lewis spent the rest of his column arguing Jackson's side. The most Clinton had been able to muster in response to a rap singer's endorsement of racist murder was to say that such sentiments were filled with a kind of hatred, and that left Anthony Lewis on the fence. Even taking the most menacing image of the religious right haunting liberal nightmares, little old ladies saying the rosary beads outside abortion clinics, the religious right is arguably less extreme than a rap singer's endorsement of the random slaughter of white people. But Clinton's tepid rebuke of a specific racist statement by an actual person is constantly cited to prod Republican candidates into denouncing Christian conservatives simply for being Christian conservatives. In the 2000 presidential campaign, for example, Senator John McCain was fulsomely praised by the media for his own sister soldier moment. McCain had viciously attacked the religious right with a ferocity normally reserved for terrorists. He called Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance and forces of evil. No one ever pinpointed exactly what Falwell and Robertson had done that was so justly deserving of McCain's wrath. Their only manifest offense was to believe in a being even higher than the New York Times. But the establishment lemmings were in a swoon. Postulating the existence of the ghosts of liberal imaginations and pursuing the logic of their paranoia, what is the threat posed by the religious right precisely? Is the nation in imminent danger of having its coarseness removed? When anal sex, oral sex, and premarital sex are all gleefully laughed about on primetime TV, the peril of religious values infecting the culture would seem to be somewhat overrated. Liberal dogma instructs that public displays of religion are inimical to democracy, a threat to freedom as we know it. They believe religious people are self-evidently fanatical. Religious values are hateful, homophobic, sexist, racist, and the rest of the liberal catechism, unless they are kept in the closet. It is, of course, preposterous to say that religious people can't let their religion inform their views on public policy. That is more hateful and intolerant than any views attributed to the apocryphal religious right. But that's what liberals believe, and one could have a more thoughtful debate with snake handlers about the wisdom of fondling poisonous snakes than with liberals about the religious right. An op-ed piece in USA Today titled, "Can a Deeply Religious Person Be Attorney General?" questions John Ashcroft's qualification for the job, expressly because of his deep faith, which could make it, quote, impossible to see other points of view. The other points of view included those of, quote, casino operators, family planning counselors, and gays and lesbians. In a fascinating contrast, the column specifically compared Ashcroft's troubling religious beliefs to Joe Lieberman's joyful invocation of the power of God on the campaign trail, a joyful invocation that included Lieberman's likening Clinton to Moses. Interviewing independent prosecutor Ken Starr during his investigation of an adulterous felon, ABC's Diane Sawyer informed Starr that the American people had responded to Starr by saying, "You are the only one who is shocked. We are not shocked." Apparently, the Russians were a little bit shocked. Russian intelligence knew about Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky before America did. Sawyer asked Starr if he was simply pursuing his private view of personal morality. At that point in the investigation, Clinton was known to have molested subordinates, perjured himself, suborned perjury, lied to the country, smeared witnesses against him, and engaged in sodomic acts involving a cigar on Easter Sunday, among many other infractions. 80% of respondents told pollsters they believed it possible that the president was a rapist. Only a religious fanatic would be troubled by any of that. Sawyer probed Starr's peculiar sectarian views with tenacity, asking Starr if he believed dancing was wicked and whether his religious beliefs were fueling his legal work. Questions like, "Do you think God is on your side?" as Sawyer also asked Starr, have a wonderful apostolic quality to them. all-powerful American institutions speak as one against the menace of morality in American life. Yet liberals behave as if they are under constant threat of extermination from the religious right. The imaginary threat of the religious right is important because it allows liberals to complain about their victimization by religious zealots. It is not sufficient psychic compensation to be applauded wildly on politically incorrect and other late-night TV shows, profiled in fawning articles in the New York Times, photographed for People magazine, showered with awards, Pulitzer Prizes, and other sundry tributes. Liberals insist that they also be admired for their bravery in standing up to Christians. Never have acts of cowardice been so lavishly hailed as raw courage. In any random month, a series of no-account actresses can be found courageously advancing their careers by attacking the Catholic Church in glossy magazines. You would think it would be difficult to be taken seriously as a martyr while being favorably profiled in Vanity Fair. But that's the beauty of modern-day martyrdom. You never have to suffer. In the February 2001 Vanity Fair, Laura Flynn Boyle announced her long-standing defiance of the Catholic Church. "I used to lie in confession all the time. I'd never tell them what I really did, never. I don't trust the Catholic Church." Proving their point, she also said, "I got a terrible education from the nuns and the Jesuits. They kept flunking me and saying I wasn't participating. I grew up thinking I was stupid." That same month, starlet Heather Graham boldly told Talk Magazine, "Organized religion, in my experience, has been destructive." This turned out to be a smashingly newsworthy comment, as it always is. Starlet Graham continued with the script mocking a 2,000-year-old religion. "Why do I have to do what all these men are saying? Why is a woman's sexuality supposed to be so evil?" In response to programmed attacks by these worthless silicone nothings leveled at a 2,000-year-old church, the mainstream media reflexively issued their own programmed response. Wild acclaim for the starlet's intrepid witticisms. When condemning religion, strict rules must be followed. It is never ministers, rabbis, priests, churches, Moses, Jesus Christ, or even just religion that is the problem. The proper malediction is organized religion. But like many popular cliches, the opposition to organized religion is an utterly meaningless formulation. There are boatloads of religions and thousands of ways religion is organized and practiced. If absolutely none of them float your boat, it may not be a problem of organization. One of the most ludicrous self-made martyrs of the religious right is Jesse Ventura, governor of Minnesota. Among many other wildly novel comments in his 1999 interview with Playboy magazine, Ventura attacked organized religion. "Organized religion," he said, "is a sham and a crutch for weak-minded people who need strength in numbers." This is in contradistinction to the herd of individualists condemning organized religion. Ventura followed the starlet script, saying religion tells people to go out and stick their noses in other people's business. The religious right wants to tell people how to live. Topping off his bigotry with a tribute to his own immense tolerance, Ventura said, "I live by the golden rule, treat others as you'd want them to treat you. The religious right wants to tell people how to live." His only self-criticism was, "I will always be honest, and I think that's my problem." Almost overnight, Ventura's approval ratings plummeted 19 points. But that was with voters. Among the cultural elites, Ventura's popularity soared. This was quite a feat, since Ventura had taken the opportunity of an interview with a pornographic magazine to commit liberal heresy on the subject of sexual harassment. He said the tailhook scandal, or as he put it, grabbing a woman's breast or buttock, was much ado about nothing. Ventura may not be an original thinker, but he was smart enough to know how to spin his interview with the media. In short order, his spokesmen were rushing to explain that Ventura had only meant to criticize extremists of the religious right, who are often intolerant. In a priceless formulation, the spokesman said his boss, the loud-mouthed anti-Christian bigot, cannot stand intolerance. Clarifying that his attack was on the religious right, and the governor cannot stand intolerance, was the equivalent of saying 50 Hail Marys as far as the liberal clergy was concerned. As with Clinton, feminist hysteria can be silenced for the greater good of undermining the nation's morals. The media responded with gushing praise for Ventura's frank honesty and daunting courage. Newsweek rushed out a major feature piece on the unimportant governor, calling Ventura beguiling, blunt, a maverick. The article praised him for his candid talk. Of his invective against religion, the magazine explained, he had a small point. A caveat at the end of his diatribe seemed to imply that he was talking at least partly about the religious right. Newsweek quibbled with Ventura only for his lack of subtlety. Even blunt talk has its limits, and Ventura appears bent on finding them. Similarly, after Senator John McCain assailed Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell as agents of intolerance and forces of evil, Time magazine lamented that the uproar had erased the nuance in his original argument. One must be careful to achieve the proper nuance when attacking Christians. Time magazine followed Newsweek a few months later with a feature article on Ventura, explaining in the first paragraph that Ventura meant only some religions, you know, the bad ones that have rules and things. Time lauded Ventura for his authenticity. Today's political culture craves authenticity, but bristles when it actually gets some. Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen devoted an entire column to lionizing Ventura for his important insights on reactionaries in the religious right. Their views are so retrograde, their thinking so inexplicable, Cohen rationally explained, that it is simply asking too much to accord them the respect normally due religious leaders. Columnist Molly Ivins praised Ventura for, surprise, his courage. Quote, "When was the last time you heard a politician take on the religious right?" she demanded to know. Finally, someone was willing to take on the witches of Salem. Ivins fancies herself an iconoclast even while adopting all the appropriate prejudices and hatreds of a good Smith College, Columbia School of Journalism graduate. Her coffee mug bravely proclaims, "Well-behaved women rarely make history," and a book of her columns was titled, "Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?" What precisely does Ivins say that everyone else is not saying? Since when is attacking the religious right a sign of anything but impeccably good manners? It's not as if she's doing something shocking, like defending Jerry Falwell. Along with the rest of the blabocracy, she slays all the standard media whipping boys and then demands that we pretend they were dragons. Though there was no shortage of journalists and pundits defending Ventura from an anticipated counterattack from Christians, the attack never materialized. A few months after his snotty, unprovoked assault on them, Ventura received 300 long-stemmed red roses with a card from churches, ministries, and individual Christians of the Twin Cities who wish simply to bless you and extend to you their prayers for you to have a wonderful Christmas. Notwithstanding the kind, generous, sometimes self-deprecating responses of the weak-minded, to say nothing of the universal acclaim for Ventura, somehow he was portrayed as the victim. One columnist concluded that the whole affair demonstrated that America is most virulently intolerant of one group, the irreligious. Ventura, she lamented, was greeted with a torrent of criticism and a plunge in his approval ratings. He got flowers. What does he want? Sex? It wasn't enough for Ventura to omit fashionable pieties of the day. He must be hailed as a martyr when he insults the powerless on behalf of the powerful. The religious right is a totemic symbol, a permanent terrorizing influence on the brainwashed masses. The vast shadowy army of the religious right can never be defeated. Periodic, apparently decisive victories against the religious right serve merely to inspire liberals in the absence of an inspiring ideology. Every few years, the religious right is defeated, but then always manages to stage a comeback with no explanation or reference to its earlier total annihilation. During its 10 years in existence, the moral majority seemed to be constantly losing clout, interrupted on occasion by hysterical reports of its burgeoning influence. At its inception in 1980, a columnist in the Washington Post was already anticipating victory, rhetorically asking, "Will the 340,000 members of the moral majority have as much impact on the election, for example, as the approximately 16 million labor union members who are registered to vote?" But then 1 year later, the Washington Post's David Broder was anxiously reporting that an intensely religious minority was shaping our politics and government. They were doing so because of their penchant for activities that make them politically influential. The infernal block voting and financial resources again. Broder's information was based on a public opinion survey, the results of which, he said, had flabbergasted the people who took the survey. And then in 1983, the religious right was faltering. Newsweek stated, religious conservatives were trying to rebuild their influence after being frustrated by a series of electoral losses at the local level. By 1984, the wily religious right was back. It had returned and was more powerful than ever. The Christian Science Monitor cited civil libertarians, academics, and other observers who declared the religious right better organized and funded than in 1980. It was a powerful force capable of getting its conservative social agenda enacted. Years later, in 1989, the official dispatch arrived. The moral majority was closing its doors. The Boston Globe gleefully reported that Falwell acknowledged the moral majority was never a large membership organization. USA Today reported that the moral majority had lost clout. It quoted Falwell expert Professor Robert Alley of the University of Richmond, concluding, "Closing down the moral majority is somewhat like closing down an abandoned house." Everyone, especially experts, agreed that the closing of the moral majority meant the religious right was D.E.D. dead. But then, just a year later, the religious right had to be vanquished all over again. This time, the focus was Pat Robertson, head of the Christian Coalition. Reviewing a book that told the story of this final glorious victory over the religious right, a Los Angeles Times headline proclaimed, "Fierce in the 80s, fallen in the 90s, the religious right forgets politics." It could finally be declared, the Wicked Witch was dead. There was even a book about it. The battle against the religious right had been a nail-biter. The Los Angeles Times reminded readers of erstwhile presidential candidate Pat Robertson's war chest of $17 million. To put that war chest in perspective, labor unions alone gave $15 million to Gore in the 2000 campaign. A, quote, Republican operative recounted the heyday of the religious right, saying the Robertson campaign was what a Nazi pep rally would have been like. The group was whipped into a froth. It was a real mob mentality. They were like sheep. In short, he said, it was scary. But that was over now. Sleep peacefully, liberals. And yet somehow, Christian conservatives emerged again. In 1993, 3 years after the headline, Religious Right Forgets Politics, and 4 years after the moral majority was shut down like an abandoned house, the religious right had gained strength again. The power of the religious right, according to the Washington Post, shook official Washington. Congressmen were quoted as calling the religious right intimidating, saying it was more influential than the bankers, more influential than the real estate industry, and as powerful as any single labor union in America. All this despite the fact that, as was duly noted in the exact same article, the gospel lobby consisted of flocks that are, quote, largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. These must have been some easily intimidated congressmen. By July 1994, the religious right was an impotent carcass again. In USA Today, a columnist declared, "The influence of conservative evangelicals within the Republican Party is probably weaker today than at any point in the past 15 years. But by November of 1994, the religious right was back in the saddle, trying to impose its values on others. ABC World News Tonight ran a show ominously titled, Christian Coalition Gaining Strength. The highlight read, "The Christian Coalition is among the most powerful and well-organized political movements in the U.S., dominating the GOP in more than a dozen states. Critics say it wants to impose its values on everyone." And then, 2 years later, according to the New York Times, the religious right was routed. By 1998, they were out again, so they must have snuck back in since 1996. As explained in an article on conservative Christians titled Coalition's Political Power Ending, 1998 might be remembered as the year that began their exile from the promised land of the Republican Party. But the religious right bounced back to exercise inordinate influence on President George W. Bush. This time, they went so far as to infiltrate the Department of Justice, appointing one of their own as Attorney General. Yet and still, after Pat Robertson resigned as president of the Christian Coalition in December 2001, an op-ed column in the New York Times announced that victory had finally been achieved. Noting the declining importance of the man and his movement, the column cheerfully stated, "The Christian Coalition has been losing members and financial support for years." Not only is there no meaningful definition of the religious right, there is no coherence to its lifespan. It's uncanny how Orwellian it is. The religious right cannot be defined beyond the broadest generalities, its leaders are unknown, it exercises vast, inexplicable influence, and it is constantly being vanquished, only to rise again. Having created a mythical enemy and trained the public to reflexively hate it, the myth can later be deployed to discredit anyone by saying he is a member of the religious right. Thus, instinctively, the entire talking head cabal knew just what to say about John Ashcroft, Bush's nominee for attorney general. He was religious right, Christian conservative, arch-conservative, far-right, mean-spirited, wingnut, and divisive. Liberals are like cats. They have a pre-programmed set of strictly limited behaviors. They all have the same twitches, the same tropes, the same paranoias. It's fascinating how consistent it is. The Los Angeles Times described Ashcroft as a champion of the religious right and noted that, despite his religious beliefs, he said his mission as attorney general will be to enforce the law. According to observers, the article continued, the key issue with Ashcroft was how his strong beliefs and political ties on abortion might shape his performance as attorney general. NBC's Tom Brokaw referred to Ashcroft as a Christian activist. NBC anchor Brian Williams opened the nightly news on December 22, 2000, saying that Bush's selection of Ashcroft calms the far right politically. Newsweek assistant managing editor Evan Thomas called the Ashcroft nomination a sop, I assume, to buy off the wingnuts. Wall Street Journal Washington editor Al Hunt called the nominee mean-spirited for voting against spending taxpayer money on government programs supported by Al Hunt. In a particularly comical article in the witch hunt tradition, the New York Times ran a banner headline, "Religious Right Made Big Push to Put Ashcroft in Justice Department." Taking a slightly more prominent above-the-fold position than the other two front-page articles that day, also attacking Bush nominees, the article nervously warned of the power of the Christian right. As proof that Ashcroft represented the Christian right, the Times used the phrase Christian right approximately 80 billion times. The Church of the New York Times was invoking its infallibility to proclaim, "Ooh, yuck, he's icky." The newspaper of record breathlessly went on to report that, if confirmed, Mr. Ashcroft would reach the highest office ever attained by a leading figure of the Christian right. It was almost as if there were a real identifiable entity known as the Christian right, replete with officers, membership lists, and ID cards. This was a scoop bigger than the Pentagon Papers. The New York Times had somehow obtained the membership list of an organization that doesn't exist. And Ashcroft was on track to get the most plum government job out of the whole lot of them. Further evidence that Ashcroft was the favorite son of the Christian political movement was that he had received generous financial backing from its members. There are no members. Indeed, the paper reported, Ashcroft received more political money from religious groups and clergymen than any other Senate candidate. That newsflash warranted above-the-fold front-page coverage in the New York Times. You had to persevere to the flip page to find out that the torrent of Christian right money being funneled to Ashcroft consisted of Pat Robertson and two other guys contributing money to a political action committee founded by Ashcroft. In all, the crack investigative reporters determined that out of $8.6 million in campaign contributions to Ashcroft in the 2000 election cycle, a whopping $23,577 came from religious groups. The largest contribution came from a personal friend of Ashcroft's and was made posthumously by the man's daughter. The Times actually tracked down the daughter to delve deeper into the motive behind the donation. On rigorous cross-examination by the Times reporters, the daughter admitted she, quote, knew of her father's support for Mr. Ashcroft on a range of issues, among them taxes and education. The country had just been through an administration in which the Chinese could give a campaign contribution to the president and end up with a naval base in Long Beach, California, and the New York Times was hyperventilating about a perfectly legal political donation from someone who agreed with Ashcroft on taxes and education. Liberals hate religion because politics is a religion substitute for liberals, and they can't stand the competition. There's a reason the left's rhetoric bears such a striking resemblance to some of the nuttier religions. Abhorring real religions, liberals refuse to condemn what societies have condemned for thousands of years, e.g., promiscuity, divorce, illegitimacy, homosexuality. Consequently, the normal human instinct to condemn something bubbles up against a legion of quite modern vices, such as smoking, fur, red meat, excessive consumption, and land development. Loathing of the religious right becomes an end in itself, a consuming passion. Liberals denounce Christian conservatives for being moralistic, for imposing their morality on others, for not separating morality from politics, and for bringing religious zeal to public life. And then work themselves into a frothing frenzy of righteous moralistic zeal over their own moral excellence for being so rational, calm, and detached. One is reminded of the sadistic moralists from Dickens' novels, who latch on to the idea that whipping is good for the child so they can beat the hell out of him and feel good about themselves while doing it. Consider the frenzy of indignation over George W. Bush speaking at Bob Jones University. For their religious convictions, which among other things dictate a belief in their own religion and an opposition to interracial dating, Bob Jones University has long provoked unbridled rage on the left. The media would have you think this serious religious college is overrun with slack-jawed hoodlums sporting swastikas and shaved heads, rather than gentle, earnest Christians. Most shamelessly, liberals pretended to be deeply wounded by Bush's appearance at Bob Jones University, on behalf of Catholics. After 20 years of left-wing Catholic bashing, this was a rather aggressive position to take. Just a few months earlier, for example, liberals had been indignantly defending a taxpayer-subsidized, pornographic portrayal of the Virgin Mary on display at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. The New York Times doggedly refuses to mention that the Virgin Mary artwork was decorated with close-up photos of women's vaginas from pornographic magazines, preferring instead to refer only to the cow dung, also on the Virgin Mary. Christians were crazy to be upset about something so repellent the New York Times refuses to mention it in print. Writing in the Sunday London Times about the ensuing brouhaha, New York Times columnist Andrew Sullivan had nothing but contempt for Catholics who had taken offense at the smutty Virgin Mary. He accused them of tone-deaf self-righteousness and sneered that they were lining up for victim status. The proper response, Sullivan patiently instructed the flock, was a laugh or groan. So it was interesting that, just a few months later, when the issue was George Bush speaking at Bob Jones University, Sullivan decided a laugh or groan simply would not do. This time, writing in the New York Times, Sullivan bitterly remonstrated against George Bush for speaking at a private Christian school, whose past president had some rather pointed condemnations of Catholicism. Working himself into a towering frenzy of self-pity about the very existence of such a place, Sullivan indulged in painful reminiscences about the anti-papist slights he had suffered as a child growing up as an Irish Catholic in England. Though he vowed never to forget that Bush had spoken at Bob Jones University, he didn't seem to have much trouble forgetting an article he'd written in the London Times a few months earlier. What does Bob Jones University have over taxpayer funding for a pornographic display of the Virgin Mary? More relevant, what does Bob Jones have over the Reverend Al Sharpton? In the 2000 presidential campaign, the entire Democratic Dream Team, Al Gore, Bill Bradley, and Hillary Clinton, all eagerly met with Al, these are not my suits, Sharpton. There was not a peep about Democratic presidential candidates making the obligatory campaign stop with Sharpton. Bob Jones never falsely accused decent men of raping and defiling Tawana Brawley and then refused ever to apologize. Bob Jones never incited ugly mob hatred toward Orthodox Jews, culminating in the murder of Yankel Rosenbaum. Bob Jones didn't compare Israel to hell, and if he had, it would have been mentioned in more than one passing aside in Newsweek. In 1991, Sharpton replied to a Tel Aviv heckler yelling, "Go to hell," by saying, "I am in hell already. I am in Israel." The incident was largely ignored by the media. Instead, reporters were probably camped outside Liberty Baptist College, hoping Falwell would say something about gays. Part of the reason liberals prefer invective to engagement is that, as Richard Nixon said of Alger Hiss, if Americans knew what they really believed, the public would boil them in oil. Liberals have been wrong about everything in the last half century. They were wrong about Stalin, praised in the New York Times and known as Uncle Joe to Franklin Roosevelt. They were wrong about Reagan. Won the Cold War and now polling as the greatest president of the 20th century. They were wrong about the Soviet Union, defeated by the 20th century's greatest president. They were wrong even about their precious Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War. The disgorging of Soviet archives proves that the Lincoln Brigade was part of a rigidly controlled Soviet operation. They were wrong about Nicaragua. Communist dictatorships in Latin America turned out not to be inevitable revolutions after all. They were wrong about welfare, since overhauled by Republicans to notable success. They were wrong about crime. Giuliani's achievement is evident in the number of candidates who promised to continue his policies. They were wrong about Social Security, now bankrupt. They were wrong about the Civil Rights Act, which was never going to be used as an instrument of discrimination against whites. They were wrong on the sexual revolution. Witness the explosions of AIDS, herpes, chlamydia, hepatitis B, and abortion. It's not an accident that, today, the left's single biggest cause is global warming. This time, conservatives won't be able to prove them wrong for 1,000 years. Most devastating for the left as a cohesive political movement was the collapse of their beloved Soviet Union. For decades, the great issue uniting various forces on the left, from proclaimed communist to soft anti-anti-communist, was the socialist ideal. Great society programs have run their course and have been a disaster. With impeached former President Clinton having proclaimed the era of big government over, even his wife Hillary has averred that there are not government solutions to most of society's problems, few people pin their dreams of a brighter tomorrow on yet one more government program. Apart from global warming, coming in 1,000 years to a planet near you, the left's only remaining cause is abortion. For many Democrats, Roe v. Wade is the essence of politics. At the 2000 Democratic National Convention, presidential candidate Al Gore won the loudest, most sustained applause for his promise to protect abortion. This was in a speech that was a virtual whirligig of promises for working families, a euphemism for families in which no one works. Gore offered targeted tax cuts, universal health care coverage for children, smaller class sizes, new gun and tobacco laws, and prescription drug benefits for seniors. His speech included surefire audience pleasers, such as his pledge to pass a hate crimes law and to oppose school vouchers. He mentioned national defense and got only a lukewarm reaction. He mentioned America's role in freeing the world from fascism and communism, polite applause. He said he would fight for the victims of crime, sporadic clapping. But the mere mention of Roe v. Wade and total pandemonium broke loose. Abortion rights would be an odd single issue for any political party. But it is nearly unbearable for a party that prides itself on moral self-righteousness. Instead of their typical smug certitude, abortion makes many Democrats queasy. This is something new. It is unusual for liberals not to conceive of themselves as Christ on the cross and their political opponents as Nazi stormtroopers. The messy details of abortion are a bad fit with the left's preference for haughty indignation. The absurd backward rhetoric that associates abortion rights with women's lives exposes the dissonance. There is no question but that something gets killed in an abortion, whether one considers that thing worthy of life, like a human, or unworthy of life, like crabgrass. But the pro-killing side of the debate flips the facts upside down to claim that they are protecting women's lives, as opposed to women's convenience. At best, some women's lives would be saved by abortion if one presupposes women will make good on their threat to, first, refuse to use birth control, and second, when they get pregnant, engage in unsafe and illegal abortion procedures. Which is kind of a stretch if you think about it. Where there is a vacuum of ideas, paranoia slips in. Much of the left's hate speech bears greater similarity to a psychological disorder than to standard political discourse. The hatred is blinding, producing logical contradictions that would be impossible to sustain were it not for the central element faith plays in the left's new religion. The basic tenet of their faith is this. Maybe they were wrong on facts and policies, but they are good and conservatives are evil. You almost want to give it to them. It's all they have left. But the personal invective is getting a teensy bit wearying. It always takes an enormous amount of exertion just to ascertain what liberals are so damn upset about. Once you finally figure out what has propelled the tolerant crowd into frenzies of demonic rage, it invariably turns out to be a perfectly ordinary view held by many good-hearted Americans. A classic of the genre was a New York Times editorial on Newt Gingrich, about whom liberals were also wrong. When Republicans won the House of Representatives for the first time in 50 years, the Times ran a welcoming editorial to mark the occasion titled, Newt Gingrich, Authoritarian. Among other utterly pointless criticisms, the Times accused Gingrich of being in the throes of post-election gloating. Despite the length of the Times diatribe, what made Gingrich an authoritarian remained murky. The only point that came through clearly was that the New York Times really disliked Gingrich. I mean, really. Mr. Gingrich wants to be obeyed, the Times psychoanalyzed, both within a Republican majority that exists mainly to rubber stamp his legislative menu, and within a country where behavior would be regulated by a society that is emphatic about right and wrong. The Times was clearly indignant about the idea of a society that is emphatic about right and wrong. But apart from Gingrich opposing the Times' evident preference for a society that is ambivalent about right and wrong, it wasn't manifest why the editors were frightened of this man. Bereft of winning issues, persuasive arguments, or real ideas, liberals are bitter. The one impulse that consistently unites them is hate. It is an arresting fact that an impeached, disgraced, disbarred Democratic president successfully rallied liberals to his cause merely by calling his opponents right-wing Republicans. The hate-mongering and name-calling on the left might be a droll irrelevancy, except that it has a debilitating effect on real issues. It is often absurdly said that scandals such as Gary Hart's affair with Donna Rice will discourage young idealists from going into politics. This is mainly said by Gary Hart. Of course, another possible response to adultery scandals involving politicians is not good people avoiding politics, but politicians avoiding adultery. By contrast, it is surely true that if holding political opinions can itself be scandalous, fewer people are going to want to have any of those opinion things. Lies and personal attacks are deeply corrosive of public debate and democratic compromises. Of necessity, therefore, almost all serious political debate takes place exclusively among conservatives, out of earshot of the children so as not to upset them. Not coincidentally, for about 20 years now, all new ideas have bubbled up from the right wing. It's amazing how productive debate can be when one is not constantly being called a racist. Almost by definition, all new ideas are right wing, whether dubbed conservative or libertarian. Where are the great liberal thinkers? Some of the new public policy ideas to bubble up from the right wing are school vouchers, welfare reform, the flat tax, quality of life crimes, privatizing Social Security, videotaping criminal confessions, the Strategic Defense Initiative, pollution tax credits, enterprise zones, and winning the Cold War. These ideas were once ridiculed by liberals. Shut up, they explained. But despite liberals' infernal squawking, these ideas are changing the world. To take one example, when President Clinton triangulated on welfare reform, the left denounced him for capitulating to Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress. This was true. Despite Clinton's campaign pledge to end welfare as we know it, somehow it took a Republican Congress coming in 2 years later to enact welfare reform. Clinton's complex-sounding triangulation was nothing more than capitulation on the installment plan. By the year 2001, one of the Democratic officials who had resigned from the Clinton administration to protest the Republicans' welfare reform made this startling and welcome admission. "In many ways, welfare reform is working better than I thought it would. The sky isn't falling anymore. Whatever we have been doing over the last 5 years, we ought to keep going." Another example of Republican progress in the face of liberal carping is Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Throughout his wildly successful mayoralty, Giuliani was regularly protested as Adolf Giuliani and portrayed with a Hitler mustache. By the end of his term, even before September 11th, he had cleaned up the city so spectacularly that his prospective successors were tripping over one another in their rush to promise to continue his policies. And after September 11th, Giuliani's heroic status was so daunting he could have gotten a table at Elaine's. It was not surprising that Giuliani performed magnificently when New York came under a savage terrorist attack. What was surprising, stunning in fact, is how liberals began saying novenas to his immortal soul. In a break from their otherwise fiendish cleverness, the hijackers' one grievous miscalculation had been to attack Manhattan, the stronghold of domestic liberalism. The only thing the terrorists could have done to instill greater fear in Manhattanites would have been to release a list of rent-controlled apartments. The city was in a panic. After September 11th, the average New Yorker faced a risk of death or bodily harm not seen since David Dinkins was mayor. Thus, liberal Manhattan began worshiping Giuliani, and also to detract from President Bush's spectacular performance. There was no question, for example, but that Time magazine would make Giuliani Man of the Year. It might have been the mastermind of the attack, Osama bin Laden, but it sure wasn't going to be Bush. In a fascinating case study of liberal hate and paranoia, Andrew Sullivan, former editor of The New Republic and writer for The New York Times, actually sought the company of conservatives. And not just any conservatives. He went to the belly of the beast, or the enemy, as he put it, attending a Christian Coalition gala in honor of Pat Robertson's 70th birthday. Sullivan breathlessly reported back to liberals the breaking news that Christian Coalition members are people, too. They seemed neither fanatics nor bigots. And thus the left was forced to come to terms with its own bigotry. Just kidding. Sullivan's own small step forward turned out not to be a giant leap for liberal kind. The precise reaction he received from his liberal friends was redoubled hatred and loathing. As Sullivan reported, they viscerally compared the event to a Nazi rally and said that I might have met many personally charming advocates of bigotry there as well. After an agonizing exegesis on his own soul-searching, most human goods are alloyed with most human failings. Sullivan cheerfully resolved that Robertson was intolerant, but not evil. Having himself ventured onto enemy territory, Sullivan concluded by proposing that Christian conservatives meet and spend time with some of the radicals they claim to be fighting against. Then, he said, they might see that the boogeymen of the cultural left are not quite as terrifying as they thought, but are human beings too. This might not change their minds, he said, but it might change their tone. In point of fact, conservatives do spend time with the radicals they oppose, and lots of it. It can't be avoided. Liberals are forever leaping out at us from our TV screens, newspapers, magazines, movies, and college lecterns. We know liberals, and we know what they think. Unlike Sullivan's exotic incursion into a right-wing gathering, any conservative can already attach names and faces to entire colonies of liberals. Ironically, regular church-going middle-class Americans are far more cosmopolitan than the self-styled sophisticates of the left. This isn't merely to say that liberals have near-exclusive control over all major sources of information in this country, though that is true. Nor is the point that liberals are narrow-minded and parochial, incapable of seeing the other fellow's point of view, though that is also true. And it's not that, as a consequence, liberals impute inhumanity to their political opponents and are unfathomably hateful and vicious. That's true, too. The point is that conservatives in America are the most tolerant and long-suffering people in the world. They already have met and spent time with liberals. They do it every day, day in, day out, their entire lives. Andrew Sullivan spends a few hours at a conservative gathering, and it's a milestone. Conservatives are bludgeoned with opposing views their every waking moment, and merely for refusing to join the cult, they are denounced as intolerant. By contrast, liberals have absolutely no contact with the society they decry from their Park Avenue redoubts. The day after seven-time NASCAR Winston Cup champion Dale Earnhardt died in a race at the Daytona 500, almost every newspaper in America carried the story on the front page. Stock car racing had been the nation's fastest-growing sport for a decade, and NASCAR the second most-watched sport behind the NFL. More Americans recognize the name Dale Earnhardt than, say, Maureen Dowd. Manhattan liberals are dumbly blinking at that last sentence. It took the New York Times 2 days to deem Earnhardt's death sufficiently important to run a major story on Earnhardt on the front page. Demonstrating the left's renowned populist touch, the article began. His death brought a silence to the Walmart. The Times went on to report that in vast swaths of the country, people watched stock car racing. Tacky people were mourning Dale Earnhardt all over the South. Except for occasional exotic safaris to the Walmart, or forays into enemy territory at a Christian Coalition dinner, liberals do not know any conservatives. It makes it easier to demonize them that way. It's well and good for Andrew Sullivan to talk about a truce. But conservatives aren't the ones who need to be jolted into the discovery that the boogeymen of their imaginations are not quite as terrifying as they thought. Conservatives already know that the people they disagree with politically can be charming. Also, savagely cruel bigots who hate ordinary Americans and lie for sport.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right by Ann Coulter. This program was produced by Laura Wilson and directed by Lisa Kahn. Abridgment by Peter Michalos. Text copyright 2002 by Ann Coulter. Production copyright 2002, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.